From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Josiah Thompson is a philosophy professor turned private eye. Whether he's tracking down an adulterous spouse or getting information on a terrorist, he refuses to carry a gun. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Josiah Thompson, private eye. Stand-up comic Jonathan Katz realized a dream in the new film Things Change when he got to play one of those tacky showbiz comics he loved as a kid. Coming up, I speak with Katz about Things Change and his longtime friendship with director and screenwriter David Mamet. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three new albums that debuted this week on Billboard magazine's Top Pop Album chart. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Good Mother, starring Diane Keaton and directed by Leonard Nimoy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Josiah Thompson is a detective who can quote Sam Spade and Kierkegaard. Before Thompson learned how to tail cars and track down missing children, he was a professor of philosophy at Haverford College. How the professor became a private eye is the subject of Thompson's new book, Gumshoe. He describes, among other things, how he learned to make surveillance an arcane meditation. Last year, he was named Best Detective of 1987 in the Bay Guardian in San Francisco, where he works. In 1976, Thompson was a tenured professor in his mid-30s, a former Guggenheim Fellow, and the author of three books, including a biography of Kierkegaard. He went on a one-year sabbatical that year from Haverford and moved with his family to San Francisco, where he planned to write a book about Nietzsche. The book was never written. Thompson got sidetracked. I asked him how he ended up working for a detective agency.
Well, not carefully, that's for sure. I went to California in the summer of 76 to write a critical biography of Nietzsche. The biography didn't get written, my marriage ran into troubles, and at a certain point, Hal Lipset offered me a job. Hal Lipset is a distinguished private investigator. And I started to work and took to the work like a duck to water.
What did you like about it?
What I liked about it was a number of things. I liked about the fact that the work wasn't in language, it was in the world. And for 12, 14, however many years, I've been working in language. I liked the fact that working as a detective, you knew if you won or lost really quickly. If you're tailing somebody and you lose them, you lost. If you stick to them, you won. Liked the fact that there was a kind of gritty hardness to it, that to do it right, you, if you're doing surveillance, you have to know where the payphones are, you had to know which way the streets ran. You had to be able to take care of yourself out there in the world, and that's what I liked about it.
What's the first job that you had that taught you some of these things and made you realize you liked the work?
Well, the first job was the first job I literally had. I went in for a job interview on a motorcycle and was told an hour later I was expected in Oakland to start tailing some people in a violent strike in near the docks of Oakland. I went to that location. Found my man, and of course, immediately made the first mistake. I pulled up beside him on a motorcycle and asked my way to Berkeley. The reason for doing that was that he had already seen my plate, and I couldn't stop in a half block. He said, "Follow me," which was precisely what I had in mind doing. But of course, about a mile later on the freeway, he told me that he got off there and I should proceed along the freeway. And of course, so I lost him. I lost him that night. I lost him every time he turned around, it seemed to me, for the next 3 or 4 days.
You know, it does seem odd to me that a detective agency would put you on the job tailing somebody without any kind of preparatory work to tell you how to do it?
No, there was absolutely no preparation at all. I think in retrospect, although Hal Lipset, a friend of mine, will still not admit it, I think there was a little bit of stick it to the professor in all
this.
Oh,
right, right. Yeah. Give him his comeuppance.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
Hal thought this is pretty funny. A full professor of philosophy who he can hire for $5 an hour to work as a detective. So obviously you'd like to haze him a bit.
Well, I figure one of the things you must have learned is all the stereotypes people have about professors of philosophy.
Yeah, you mean basically the ivory tower, the guy who can't find his way across the street.
And wouldn't know how to tie his own shoes. And...
Yeah, right, right. Well, I brought some of those features into detectivery, and I suppose that's why some of my friends always refer to me as Inspector Clouseau.
My guest is Josiah Thompson, who's a professor of philosophy turned private eye, and he's written a new book about his experiences called Gumshoe. Now, you had written about Kierkegaard. Which of his ideas, if any, did you find were applicable at all, that you were thinking about in your new work as a detective?
Well, Kierkegaard is known as an existential philosopher, and his views basically compose themselves around the idea that you can't get there from here in terms of orthodox philosophy. You can't offer a picture, ultimately, of what reality is or the way the world is, that there's some fundamental ambiguity in experience. I'm reminded of Robert Penn Warren's line, the awful ambiguity of immediate experience. I think that reflects Kierkegaard's views in these things. And that's what I found again and again in the detective world, in the concrete world of work as a detective. The ambiguity of experience, the difficulty of clarifying things, the impossibility, really, of clarifying most things.
But before you were talking about how things are kind of clear-cut, you know when you win, you know when you lose. You get the information or you don't get the information.
Yeah, but then you move on to the next question. What really happened? Who really is telling the truth, right? At that level, you really run into a wall of ambiguity, I think. And that's the brilliance, actually, of Hammett in all of these things. Hammett, who I still see as the kind of patron saint of modern detective writing. Hammett did it in a different way. The Maltese Falcon, for example, the classic, Hammett's classic work, you start with a fiction, with Bridget O'Shaughnessy's false story as to who she is and what she's doing. Now, by the end of the novel, at the very end of the novel, unlike the standard Conan Doyle English detective novel, which begins with fiction and ends with truth, the butler did it or he didn't, Hammett leaves you there in the midst of ambiguity. Again, you don't know what the real story of the Falcon is. You don't know what really happened here. Some people have died. Others have been arrested. Various things have happened. But you don't know what the truth is. And it seems to me that that's the brilliance of Hammett, and a brilliance that he brought to this craft because he was the only modern detective writer who ever worked as a detective. So he knew the lesson that I had to take a year or so to learn.
Well, you agree with him that chance and luck are more important than rational thinking when it comes to actually solving a case. What's an example of how rational thinking just wasn't working for you, but chance and luck paid off?
Well, rational thinking very, very, very seldom works. I can give an immediate example of how chance and luck didn't work. On my first job, I was tailing this guy in a bus. Now, if you've ever, probably none of your listeners have really tailed anybody on a bus. It's a rather unusual sort of thing to do. But look, think of the bus. I mean, there are no windows usually in the back of a bus, and if they are, they're hopelessly oily. So if you tail a bus, you can tail right up behind the bus. It's one of the easiest tails in the world. I didn't know that. On my first tail, I tailed this bus about a block behind heavy traffic in Berkeley. Since I didn't know the Bay Area, I looked down to a map. When I looked up, there were now two buses, two identical buses heading east on Shattuck. The result of this whole thing was that I lost the man. And that's what often happens in detective work. Chance and contingency are so important. For example, you can be sitting on somebody for 8 hours and never blink and do an absolutely brilliant job. And right when he moves, a bus pulls in and blocks your way out and you lose him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, constantly one's involved in that world of time and change and contingency. And the detective life, I think, has to do basically with how you get along in that world.
I want to quote something else that you quote from Hammett. I forget which novel this is. It's one of the Sam Spade novels.
Mm-hmm.
But the quote is, "My way of learning is to leave a monkey wrench." My way of learning is to heave a monkey wrench into the machinery.
Yeah, that actually is from The Maltese Falcon. And in another series of stories about the Continental Op, he says that his mode of operation is simply to stir things up.
And you do this?
Yeah.
How so? Give an example.
Well, let me see. I'll have to find the... There is one case described in the first part of the book where I'm sent to New England. There's been a drug bust. Various things have happened, and there's $30,000 in a paper bag, and there's a can of drugs and some other things under a bush. I recover the can and now have to figure out how to get into the house to get the $30,000. Well, I stirred things up. I found first that the house was for sale, then found a realtor, went around to 5 or 6 different houses, and ultimately was successful in renting the house, which gave me access to it. And ultimately, my wife Nancy came over from California, and we recovered the $30,000. Stirring things up there had to do, I mean, how do you handle a situation like this? The DEA is sitting in the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know there's $30,000 there. What do you do? Well, you don't walk up to the door and ask the DEA agent for the $30,000 that he forgot to find in the attic. So you stir things up, you move around, get things in motion, and when you get things in motion, then other things happen, other opportunities open. And I think that's what Spade had in mind in offering that notion of throwing a monkey wrench into the works.
So what was your monkey wrench? What did you do to stir things up?
Well, simply by getting into the position now of renting a house, which was something certainly I never thought of doing when I went there. And then involving a realtor in going through various completely fake deals until finally this thing could be worked out. And then going through long, involved conversations with the owners of the house, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was to get things in motion. And once you could get things in motion, then opportunities were available.
You know, one of the fictional detective characters I really like a lot is Lou Archer, because he's such a great interviewer. You know, he really knows how to ask questions to people to get information from them. Did you find that something you had to learn, how to get information from people?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any simple way. You ought to know this of all people, Terry, because you interview such a marvelous range of people each week. I don't think there's any simple way of doing that. I think you have to really listen to what somebody's saying, and then attend to, of course, body language, tone of voice, all those things. But I think it's very individual. I don't think there's any theory of how to interview somebody. Do you?
No, I really don't. And I think it's a very personal thing, too. But you really can't betray yourself when you're a detective sometimes. You know, you have to get information without people even knowing why you want it.
Yeah, but most often it's really straightforward. Most often I find that the straighter you are, the more successful you are.
You mean the more straightforward or the more straight-looking?
Yeah, right. No, Fetchheimer, my mentor, once explained this in terms of a parable from his history as a detective. He said he had this case where he had to get into the front room of this ground floor apartment, and he agonized over how to do it and how to do it and how to do it. Finally decided, he took an operative out with him and put the operative in front of the window and threw a baseball over his head through the window into the room. Then they went up very apologetically and got entrance to the room, did or saw whatever they needed, and left. In other words, oftentimes the most effective technique is a direct one. In that case, throwing a baseball through the window.
When you started detective work, did you have to learn how to look and act tough, tougher than you might have actually felt?
Are you kidding, Terry? I'm 5'8", 150 pounds, and I'm 53 years old. Look, I can't look tough. There is no way on this planet I can look tough. Winning through intimidation is not part of my repertoire.
Well, so what techniques have you found instead to look like someone who can take care of themselves? Don't you have to do that? Look like you can take care of yourself so that nobody else intimidates you or takes advantage of you?
Well, I think it's often more useful not to look like a detective. Not to look like any of the cliché.
You mean when you're getting information from people, that's more
effective. Yeah, when I'm getting information from people. I take it that you're thinking of situations where you might be in bad areas or in unusual situations close to criminals or things like that.
I don't know. In all the detective novels I read, there's always some kind of double deal involved, or the case becomes... The case goes much deeper than the detective ever thought, and there's terrible things waiting right around the corner, and, you know, there's some kind of violence usually waiting, even though you wouldn't have expected it from the case at the beginning.
Well, look, violence is something that the real detective hardly ever experiences and certainly wants to stay far away from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't carry a gun, I never have, and I never will.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't for two different sets of reasons. One, prudential, that I'd probably shoot myself in the foot, or somebody would steal it and shoot me not in the foot, but somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that to carry the gun really means that you've dropped to the level of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I have a lot to do with areas of human life, with, as were the border between the legal and the illegal. And I don't want to sink to the subhuman and live in there. That's what the challenge is to try to maintain one's humanity in an area that's very hazardous for that. So I use my head, not a gun. If any detective ever used his gun, especially like these chaps on TV, they would have made lots of mistakes before they ever had to use their gun.
Mm-hmm.
So violence is something to stay away from. Use your head to stay away from.
Yeah, interesting points. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back. My guest is Josiah Thompson, who is a former professor of philosophy at Haverford College, but for the past few years he's been a private eye. He now is a partner in his own firm. He's written a book about his experiences as a detective. It's titled Gumshoe. More in just a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Detective Josiah Thompson is my guest, author of Gumshoe. Well, you've had your own private practice for the past few years after working with other detective agencies. What do you specialize in now that you can call the shots more?
Well, still criminal defense. Let me give you a snapshot.
Yeah.
3 weeks ago, I'm in New York right now. Three weeks ago, I was here in this area. And I was working on three different sorts of cases. One was a death penalty case for the Public Defender's Office involving scientific consultations with forensic pathologists in Pittsburgh and Atlanta. I took various pieces of tissue around, and we looked at it under the microscope, and I got their opinions and elicited their help in terms of testimony later on. That was one. The next case involved a case for Kunstler's office, the Japanese terrorist who was arrested, or the alleged terrorist who was arrested on the Jersey Turnpike with three bombs in his car. Did a little work in New Jersey on that, and then moved up to Toronto, where I have a drug case involving the arrest of six Canadians in Los Angeles for exporting... allegedly conspiring to export about a ton of non-existent hash. I thought they should get a medal from Nancy Reagan for exporting drugs out of the country, but apparently the DEA didn't see it that way. So those three cases, I mean, that gives a kind of snapshot view of what I'm doing now.
Let me ask you briefly about the terrorist case. Now, I know you're not at liberty to talk about the details of the case because mm-hmm. it's still in the courts, but this is an alleged Japanese terrorist who was found on the New Jersey Turnpike with, arms and bombs in the car?
No, there weren't any arms. I mean, I'm just speaking in terms of the press reports. The press reports report that the authorities found, I think, two or three bombs made in the form of fire extinguishers filled with black powder and shotgun pellets.
So your job was to try to find information showing that the search was illegal.
Well, my job, I'm not at liberty to certainly broadcast on radio what I was doing.
Right.
My job was to perform some investigations for the defense, as I've done in many, many other cases, and pursue whatever issues the defense had in this case.
Did you have any second thoughts about taking on a case like this, given that it's an alleged terrorist who is the client?
Oh, there's no way that any of us can choose between our clients. We don't have to like our clients. We
mm-hmm.
don't have to need any of that. Look, basically, my job is simply to go out there and get the information that the attorney or the client wants. And I can't ask those sorts of questions as to whether the person I'm working for is a nice person or an unnice person. I've probably worked for some of the most unnice persons on the planet at some point or another. But unnice persons deserve a defense just as much as nice persons. And my job is just to go out and do the job, not try to resolve that question as who ought to get a defense and et cetera.
You worked for the defense of William and Emily Harris in the Patty Hearst kidnapping to what, to prove that Hearst wasn't brainwashed?
Oh, that was an investigation a long, long time ago.
Can you tell me real briefly, like, what you did on that?
I don't think I can.
Okay, fine.
Okay. I don't think I can.
Ask me all this privileged information? Or?
Well, here's what happened. Yeah. A deal was made. The case never went to trial.
Uh-huh.
And I do have very, very strict intense strictures on what I can talk about. That's very relevant to this book because, see, I don't have a release from my clients in that case. In the book, in Gumshoe, I have releases from all these people. For example, Henry Bauer, the detective who assisted me in tying this guy up and holding him for 22 hours in Bombay as we took his child and took the child out of the country. I have a release from Henry. I have a release from the mother and child, things of that sort. So in the book, I can talk about these things legally only because I've been straight with people and they've given me their permission to talk about them. You're asking me about other cases where I just don't have that permission.
No, I understand. I didn't realize that's the way it worked, but now that you've explained it, I really understand. Something that you do write in the book that really made me think, you were in the process of working with a locksmith to get into a car for a case you were working on, and the police stopped you, handcuffed you, and thought that you were two real dangerous guys until they realized who you really were. And it made you think that if you were killed on the job, it wasn't going to happen when you were doing something glamorous or especially important, but when you least expected it. Does that kind of thought still haunt you a lot?
Yeah. If you speak of TV detectives never seem to be worrying either about what they're doing in terms of the right or wrongness of it, or worrying about whether they're going to get killed or not. I do a lot of worrying in this book about things like that. And I think one edge to the whole experience of the detective is what might be spoken of as a kind of paranoid edge. The point about it is that if you're dealing with the world, if you're out there in the world, if you have some sort of thirst for the otherness, for the raw bone of the actual, something that I have, then part of that raw bone is the fact that it can become very dangerous and that the world is not within your control. So there's this level of always looking out of the corner of your eye and vaguely being aware that when something awful happens, it's going to arrive on you very quickly and thunderously, probably from behind. I kept thinking of John Kennedy in this regard. I wrote this other book on the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. As Kennedy was driving along Houston Street, Nellie Connolly turned to him and said, "Well, Mr. President, you can't say that the people of Dallas don't love you." The car made its turn under the depository. Kennedy smiled and said, "Yes," and within seconds, the shots crashed into the limousine. That may be a kind of metaphor for at least how I view sudden death.
Yeah. Well, so how do you keep this maybe low-level, constant awareness and fear from getting out of hand and becoming disabling terror?
By self-deception and humor. For example, my partner, we've told this story many times, but my partner visited a witness, and the next person who visited the witness later on in the day got blown away. My partner has always expressed that he has a fine sense of timing about interviews.
Oh, God. during one of your cases, you were following a woman for an adultery case. She found you following her and didn't know what you were doing, thought maybe you were a peeping Tom or maybe a detective. So she asked you for some ID. You showed her a card from your former profession, your professor of philosophy card from Haverford College. And she believed you, and of course you knew the part and how to play it. Do you think Haverford knows that you still have those cards and are using them as a cover?
Well, this was my ID card from Haverford. That was used in the very first months of where actually it was valid at the time. I had not officially resigned. I was still a professor of philosophy. Now, one of the interesting things about that card concerns the writing of the book. You see, the point about Gumshoe is that they're real names and real places, real events.
Uh-huh.
It's all nonfiction, the real thing. I remembered this incident, but did not recall the whole incident with the woman, and finally got out the card and looked and noticed that there was no expiration date on the card. And that reminded me of our little conversation in which she called attention to the lack of an expiration date, and I pointed out that in small Quaker colleges on the main line, they figure that their tenured faculty will not expire very quickly. And that then became part of the conversation. So it's the ability to... I had in these files, I had photographs, I had documents, I had notes, and I had the actual ID card in this case. The possibility of referring back to those sorts of artifacts for more and more information, I found to be fascinating because it was like an archaeology about rediscovering the past all over again in the very writing of the book.
Well, do you think Haverford College is going to reprimand you?
No, I was there yesterday.
Oh, okay. Let me tell you, I interviewed a detective within the past couple of years, you know, a real-life detective, mm-hmm. who had done a lot of interviews in his time. Mm-hmm. And after the interview was over and after he kept me totally entertained with all these stories of his cases and stuff, mm-hmm. I said, so, are you still working on a case now? And he explained to me that actually in his office, he had a lot of people who he delegated all the cases to, and he basically went around doing interviews. And I'm just wondering, now that you have a book out and you're becoming kind of well-known yourself, would you want to get into that kind of situation, or would you want to prevent that from happening?
Oh, no, look, I've got live cases going on right now.
Right.
I mean, I want to be back in San Francisco in 2 days because things are really going on in these cases. No, look, earlier I was part of a larger operation. The way to make money in the detective business is you hire a lot of people, you don't pay them very much, and you charge a lot for their time.
Right,
basically.
Right.
Yeah, Marx is right. Exploitation of labor is the way you make money. Right. I don't want to do that. I ended up, when I did that before, as a... talking to lawyers and accountants. I didn't quit the academic world to become some sort of small businessman. I quit it to be a detective. I love it. And be going back to it in about 2.5 days. I better get back there in 2.5 days. No.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Josiah Thompson is a professor of philosophy turned private eye. He's written a book about his life as a detective. It's called Gumshoe, and it's published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Arnold Rampersad. The Washington Post said his 2-volume biography of writer Langston Hughes may be the best biography of a black writer we've had. It follows the development of Hughes' writing as he moved away from a political commitment to social realism to embrace a poetry that reflected his love of jazz and blues. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Jonathan Katz was an ace ping pong player, he and David Mamet ran a ping pong hustle. That was over 10 years ago. Now Mamet is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, and Katz is an up-and-coming comic. And when Mamet's new film Things Change called for a showbiz comic, he wrote the part for Katz, who we meet on this edition of Fresh Air. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker lets popular taste dictate this week's review. He turned to Billboard magazine's top pop album chart and decided to review the week's three newcomers, Anita Baker, The Bangles, and Duran Duran. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Leonard Nimoy's adaptation of The Good Mother, Sue Miller's popular novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Indian paratroopers have reportedly arrived on the Maldives Islands in the Indian Ocean to help government security forces battling an attempted coup by foreign mercenaries. The Indian cabinet ordered the troops to the Maldives in response to a plea for help from the besieged island government. Chris Nuttall is monitoring the situation from neighboring Sri Lanka.
Residents on Male say that two or three military planes were seen landing at the airport after nightfall. It's believed that ships of the Indian Navy are also either in or are heading for the area. The airstrip is on another coral island about half a mile away from Male. The residents say there has been complete quiet on the island since the planes landed. Earlier, there had been gunfire from the direction of the National Security Service headquarters, which had been besieged by the mercenaries. There are reports that paratroops have been dropped onto Male and are now moving to secure the capital. The country's leader, President Gayoom, is thought to be still in hiding somewhere on Male. At least 20 people are reported to have been killed in the fighting so far. For National Public Radio, this is Chris Nuttall reporting from Sri Lanka.
The nation's four national TV networks say they will report next Tuesday's election results as soon as they have them. NBC, CBS, ABC, and CNN say they will begin projecting winners in each state once the polls close in that state. They say they will announce the winner of the entire presidential race once either candidate wins the 270 electoral votes needed to become president. The first polls close at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Because of the three-hour time difference between the East and West Coast, the winner could be declared before the balloting ends in Western states. On the second day of a visit to Poland, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was cheered by hundreds of Solidarity supporters as she laid a wreath on the grave of a murdered pro-Solidarity priest. It was Thatcher's most open demonstration of sympathy with the outlawed trade union. At a banquet following a meeting with Communist Party chief Wojciech Jaruzelski, Thatcher said Western financial aid might be made available to economically troubled Poland if its leaders deal with the outlawed trade union. Solidarity's Lech Wałęsa has said he will respond next week to the government's latest proposal for starting talks, which have been delayed since early last month. A new anti-apartheid newspaper in South Africa is reporting that jailed black leader Nelson Mandela will be released before Christmas. From Johannesburg, NPR's John Madison has details.
The anti-apartheid newspaper, The Independent Weekly, reports in tomorrow's edition that President Botha has promised several Western governments that he will release Mandela before Christmas. The paper even gives a date, November 14th. The report appears in the first edition of a new anti-apartheid paper, the first anti-apartheid paper written in Afrikaans, the language of President Botha's ruling Afrikaner Nationalist Party. The paper's first edition appeals for the immediate and unconditional release of Mandela and all his fellow political prisoners, and for negotiations with him to bring about democracy in South Africa. It's not clear whether the government will allow the Independent Weekly to continue publishing now that it has suspended the anti-apartheid weekly Mail for a month. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
The State Department said today that the Soviet Union has fired SS-1 Scud missiles on Afghan rebels in an escalation of the war in Afghanistan. The Scud rockets were displayed in the Afghan capital of Kabul earlier this week after Undersecretary of State Michael Armacost complained to Soviet officials about sending long-range backfire bombers into combat there for the first time. The State Department said the Scud missiles were used on rebel bases located near the Pakistani border. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 13 points to close at 2170.34. Advances led decline 6-5 on volume of 154 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Usually our rock critic Ken Tucker comments on albums that really strike him, but this week he decided to just open the latest issue of Billboard magazine and review the first three new entries on the pop album chart.
The idea behind this small stunt was to force myself to ponder records I might not otherwise have considered. I need you near me, need you to be there. I can't let go of you now. Nobody loves you like I can love you. I'll just keep holding on somehow. The three new albums on the Billboard chart this week are Anita Baker's Giving You the Best That I Got, which is ranked at number 22, The Bangles' new album, Everything, which enters at number 100, and Duran Duran's Big Thing at number 109. As it turns out, I couldn't have chosen three more different albums. In fact, I never would have chosen the Anita Baker for a review, and would probably have given the Duran Duran the most cursory of listens. I like to think that my taste is eclectic, but somewhere between a passion for rock and rhythm and blues, my tendency is for something rougher, or at least less mannered, than Anita Baker's polished pop crooning. Baker came to prominence in 1986 with the album Rapture. It was a collection of lush ballads that positioned her as the female version of R&B love men like Luther Vandross and Freddie Jackson. Her new album is even more lush, a collection of moony songs whose clearly enunciated lyrics are so utterly banal that the only thing to listen to is Baker's swooping, diving voice. Ain't there something I can give in exchange for everything you give to me? Read my mind, you make me feel just fine. When I think my peace of mind is out of reach, the scales are sometimes unbalanced, and you bear the weight of all that has to be. I hope you see that you can lean on me, and together we can calm the stormy seas. When love's so strong and so unselfishly, and I tell you now that I made a vow, I'm giving you the best that I've got, baby. That's the album's title song, already a big, glossy, empty hit. For all her self-proclaimed affinities to jazz, Baker's phrasing is stiff and haughty, very unjazzy. She sings about passion but delivers it without warmth, freezing the music in a blast of cold irony. A certain ironic distance also characterizes the music of the Bangles. In this case, these four women toy with female rock and roll stereotypes, girl groups, sensitive singer-songwriters, and what used to be called chick singers. In contrast to an obvious performer like Anita Baker, the Bangles aspire to sneak their emotions into bright, clever, catchy songs. It used to be that such groups made one hit single and then faded into pop history, but the pervasive careerism of rock since the 70s has forced even so playful a group as the Bangles into an ambitiousness that has now taken them through three good albums. Still, their biggest hits have been novelties, a cover of the Paul Simon folk rock oldie Hazy Shade of Winter, and their own gimmicky Walk Like an Egyptian. What I like about the new album, Everything, is that it doesn't try to be everything, a please-all-the-people, career-sustaining sop. What it is, more or less, is an excellent rip-off of a 60s rock album, complete with groovy guitar sounds and trippy lyrics. The clearest example of this is a song called Glitter Years, a kind of musical autobiography of the band's early years in L.A. Bangles are an 80s band inspired by the 60s. Duran Duran is a 70s band that's just happened to survive 8 years into this decade. When this English group first came along, their mechanical rhythms and cute but sleazy image made them perfect for the hot medium of the moment, rock videos. But now, having sold millions of records and after a long silence theoretically spent honing their skills, Duran Duran is trying to sell itself as a collection of serious musicians, the one irrelevant arrogance they never could have been accused of until now. Drug, Duran Duran's feeble attempt to hop on the Just Say No bandwagon. The fact that this album could debut on the pop chart at number 109 suggests a certain core of devoted fans who will automatically buy anything Duran Duran puts out. But once they get an earful of this hapless bummer, the fans will probably head on to something younger and hotter.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The Bangles from their new album, Everything. This is Fresh Air. Jonathan Katz is a stand-up comic who performs pretty hip venues like Caroline's, Catch a Rising Star, and the David Letterman Show.
I shouldn't complain. It's been a wonderful year for me, ladies and gentlemen. 1985, 3 months ago, I became a father. Thank you very much. And this is, thank you. This is has got to be the most powerful experience that a man can have, to witness the birth of your child. I had read about it. I had seen the pictures, but to be there and to see the stork penetrate the uterus is, unpleasant. I had to do it. I was trained. I went through natural childbirth classes. Great place to meet chicks, by the way. You can be reasonably sure these girls put out, so I did that. I joke about childbirth. My wife, God bless her, was in labor for 32 hours. I was faithful to her the entire time. Thank you very much.
The kind of showbiz comic he's half mocking there is exactly the kind of character Katz plays in the new film Things Change. The film was co-written and directed by Katz's longtime friend, David Mamet. 11 years ago, Katz and Mamet wrote a story about con men, which Mamet later adapted into the film House of Games. In the new movie, Things Change, Jonathan Katz plays Jackie Shore, a vain, tacky showbiz comic who plays a club in Tahoe.
The day before I went out to Lake Tahoe to shoot the movie, I called David Mamet. And I said, tell me about Jackie Shore, because I hadn't seen a script or anything. And he said, don't worry, you are Jackie Shore. I get out there, guy picks me up at the airport, says, oh, you're the guy playing the sleazy comedian. So I'd like to think there is some difference between me and Jackie Shore. What I tried to do is to work a little broader than I generally work.
Mm-hmm.
And
dress a little bit differently.
Right.
You want to describe how you're dressed as Jackie Shore?
Well, A lot of gold chains. A lot of them were for my own benefit because they weren't actually seen on camera. But I wore tux on stage. I was kind of a greasy guy. But the main difference between portraying a comedian, in this case Jackie Shore, and being a comedian was that when I shot the movie, there were 250 people being paid to laugh at my jokes, as opposed to last night, you know, when there were 12 people paying to hear me laugh. To make them laugh.
Was it scary to look in the mirror and see this other guy, this tacky comic?
No, frankly. I kind of liked him.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think I'm a latent Catskill comic.
Did you go to the Catskills when you were young?
I did, yes.
Who'd you see there that made a big impression on you?
Well, actually, we used to go to Grossinger's. My father was in the Jewish business. And we used to go to conventions there, and there was a guy there. I don't remember his name, but he used to lead the guests in Simple Simon. And he was like a kind of a hack comic, and he became my idol.
Well, I want to get back to Things Change. Your name in the movie, Jackie Shore,
mm-hmm.
It just strikes me as a terrific showbiz name for a comic. Did you come up with it?
No, David came up with a bunch of names that were perfect comic lounge comedians. And then he had to clear those names, and every one of them was taken by some lounge comic.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you remember any of the names?
Well, there was Jackie Blue, Sammy Shore, who actually is a Catskill comic. Let's see. Those are the only two I remember offhand.
Mm-hmm. You co-wrote the story for House of Games
right.
with David Mamet. How did you first meet up with him?
Well, Dave and I went to college together. We went to Goddard College in Vermont, and We became pals, and we used to go around to hustling ping pong and pool at colleges. I'm a former New York State ping pong champion.
You're kidding, really?
Nope, it's a true story.
Wait, this is a skill I bet you learned in the Catskill Hotel.
You're right. Jeez, you know too much.
Ping pong's very popular up there.
Yes, but I had a great scam. I would go to colleges, and I would offer to play anybody. And spot them 15 points, and during each point, I would have to recall some painful experience from my adolescence. And no, I'm making that part up. But no, what would happen was David would go out, would play me for money, and he would be my shill. He would beat me, and then I would try to get revenge on somebody. And when in fact I was the superior player.
This is great. So you actually had a con game that you'd take around together.
Yeah.
Any others that you did?
Well, you know, we had all these elaborate cons, but it was mainly the plotting that we got a kick out of. You know, to actually do them, we were a little too scared, I think.
You know, you mean so you came up with great con games
yeah.
that you couldn't do yourself, so you incorporated them into the movie?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, David, for instance, got taken by some guy in a crap game once in New York, and we spent the next 3 years scheming how we were going to get this guy's $35 back, you know. But you know, these were real-life scary guys. And when in fact, what we really wanted to do is just to establish the fact that we could get his money back if we wanted to. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so are you saying, too, that the story for this was, in a way, your solution to getting back at him?
The story for the House of Games?
Yeah.
I think there was a certain element of revenge in there.
One of the things that I really love about House of Games is this idea. You're really playing on a kind of movie stereotype of the con man who actually is good underneath and is smitten by the love for a woman. But, of mm-hmm. course, in your stories, it turns out he really is a con. I mean, he really is just a con underneath it all.
Well, both of us have an enormous affection for con artists. I think it's obvious in David's work, but you know the original story for the House of Games was written 10 years before the actual the screenplay, and it underwent an enormous transition. Originally, it was about three mice, and it was set in space, in the future. Terry?
Yes.
I'm kidding, obviously.
I figured that out.
This is like the crowd last night. Only they weren't as vocal as you.
Well, I should explain, too, that you're sitting in a New York studio and I'm sitting in a Philadelphia studio. So you're...
It's no excuse.
Yeah, you're making these jokes in an empty room.
I have been hurt so many times.
Yeah. Oh, well. You wrote the story 10
right.
years before the screenplay
right.
got written.
We took it around town trying to get a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody was interested. And I said to David, hey, why don't you go out and get famous? And I'll meet you back here in about 10 years. And the rest, as they say, is... what do they say it is?
Oh, who can remember?
Yeah.
When did you start doing comedy?
I started doing stand-up about 7 years ago. I before that had a band called Cats and Jammers, a rhythm and blues band in New York. And I noticed over a period of time that people, as soon as I started singing, they would start talking and going to the bathroom and lighting up cigarettes. And then when the music stopped, I would have their attention. So I started catching on little by little, and I started phasing out the music and doing straight stand-up.
Are you going to be doing more movies?
Yes, I promise. I will. I'm making this promise in lieu of having an actual movie offer. I was offered a 3-picture deal with Columbia, but it was stills, so I'm holding out for the motion pictures.
Well, just think, if things get tough for you...
Terry, wait, did you hear that joke?
What? Okay. No, do it again.
You know, you can't just gloss over a joke about stills.
Busy me. I was thinking of my next question.
You
had me on that
excuse.
One. I was being a bad audience on that one.
Okay.
But I was with you most of the way.
I hate, this is the worst. My worst trait is to point out a missed punchline to the audience. I very often ask them if they see the humor in what I'm saying. But...
It's a good way to endear yourself to people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If things get real rough for you ever financially, do you think you'll dress yourself up like Jackie Shore and go perform at casinos? Now that you know you can do it.
I think I might. I hate to say it. I really, I would do it in a second for the cash.
And you still have the gold chains you can wear.
Well, I know where to find them. I know there's a pawn shop not too far from Newton. I have access to the change.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry, thanks.
Jonathan Katz lives in the Boston area, but you can catch him with his gold chains and tux as Jackie Shore in David Mamet's new film, Things Change. This is Fresh Air. Let's get the rundown on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we have a report tonight on the attempted coup in the Maldives. That's a group of islands in the Indian Ocean southwest of Sri Lanka. About 150 gunmen tried to overthrow the government there today. Indian paratroopers are there to help the government put down the violence. We also have a conversation with the author of Coup d'etat, a man by the name of Ed Luttwak. The book is a how-to on coups. He says the proliferation of mini states with small security forces makes it possible for private citizens to essentially steal their own countries by staging a coup. And finally, we have a report on the battle for California. The Democratic and Republican parties both want those votes.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Child custody disputes draw otherwise civil people into battle. The Good Mother is a new movie about the subject, starring Diane Keaton, directed by Leonard Nimoy. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
I can't get used to it. I really can't get it into my head that the number one director in Hollywood is Spock. But after making the biggest box office film of 1987, Three Men and a Baby, Leonard Nimoy is being taken very seriously indeed. He'd have to be allowed to direct the movie version of The Good Mother. Sue Miller's bestseller, after all, was a kind of litmus test to thousands of thinking women all over America. The way you responded to it told you just where you were in the post-feminist world, which values you had adopted or rejected, which adjustments you were still chewing over. Although Nimoy's version is strangely lifeless and insubstantial, it has much the same effect. It's like a TV movie in that way. The issues it raises resound long after the film's images and emotions have evaporated. Diane Keaton plays Anna Dunlap, who's just divorced her conservative husband and has custody of their little daughter, Molly. Anna lives modestly, and she lives for her daughter, until she meets Leo, played by Liam Neeson. He's a sexy sculptor, and his liberating eroticism reawakens Anna. Then, one day, Anna's ex-husband, Brian, appears on her doorstep.
I came by out of a sense of fairness, Anna. I just wanted to tell you face to face. You see, I have filed papers. There's going to be a hearing. You're going to be getting a subpoena.
Wait a minute. I would get a lawyer
if I were you.
Brian, I don't understand what you're talking about. What do you mean?
Does this guy live with you?
Well, he has his own place, but he stays with his son. Yes,
and you've left her alone with him.
Well, of course I have. She likes him. They have fun together, Brian.
Well, ask him about the fun, Anna.
Well, what are you suggesting, Brian? That he did something wrong with Molly?
He did, Anna.
Well, he didn't.
That'll be the argument in court.
Brian wants custody of Molly because he thinks Anna is exposing her to too much of her uninhibited new sex life with Leo. Apparently, Molly once surprised Leo coming out of the shower and asked if she could touch his penis. He consented, thinking that Anna's fearlessly open way of raising Molly dictated such a response. The movie conveniently leaves out one of the book's key details, Leo's resultant erection. Now, where you stand on whether what Leo did is right or wrong will determine a lot of your response to this movie. But that volatile central issue doesn't save The Good Mother from being a terribly lackluster piece of filmmaking. Nimoy can't manage to get any of the book's texture into the film. You never get the vital sense the book gives you that Anna, like so many American women, can't escape being a daughter in a world of fathers, forever feeling her way between the moralities she's been taught and the whispers of her conscience. Anna's relationship with Leo is carefully drawn, but Nimoy suddenly seems to back away from his subject once the custody case comes up. He doesn't capture the terrible inevitability the movie needs to move us. In the end, the judge's decision seems unlikely and whimsical, and the movie winds up putting us through emotional upheavals it can't justify. Meanwhile, though, there's Diane Keaton, an actress whose mere presence in a movie is reason enough to pop for a ticket. There are people who find her annoying, who find she brings her Annie Hall hemming and hawing to every role. But those traits are part of the timbre of her instrument. And when you watch what she does with them in a movie like The Good Mother, you can come to love them, as much as you love the growly parts of a saxophone or the whiny parts of a violin. Keaton is one of the bravest, most searching actresses we have, and you can see her fight for every grain of truth she delivers to this movie. Even when Nimoy's direction is pushing us to arm's length, Keaton's performance draws us near.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with Kevin Boyle, the director of Article 19, a new international human rights organization that documents the worldwide use of censorship. Censorship can be the deletion of a paragraph or the torture of a citizen who expressed opposition to the government, but in all cases, Boyle says, the most fundamental human right is threatened. Also, our performer-in-residence Harry Connick Jr. returns with his tribute to Harold Arlen. And critic Ken Tucker cuts through the hype surrounding the home video release of E.T., so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Becky Thorne. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Richard Parker. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.